So we'll continue on the section on Dhamma, Dhamma Vinaya, and it's one on the theme of the, just that Dhamma is something that is takes us further. This is just a short discourse from the Ankhutara Fives, 202. There are these five rewards in listening to the Dhamma. Which five? One hears what one has not heard before. One clarifies what one has heard before. One gets rid of doubt. One's views are made straight. One's mind grows serene. Those are five benefits. This next discourse is from Ankhutara 779. And on the nature of the Dhamma. On one occasion, the Venerable Upali approached the Blessed One. Having arrived, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side, and said, "It would be good, Lord, if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in brief, so that, having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute." When Upali, you know of certain things. These things do not lead to complete disenchantment, to dispassion, cessation, and peace, to direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. Of such teachings, you may be certain. This is not the Dhamma. This is not the discipline. This is not the Master's teaching. But Upali, when you know of certain things, these things lead to complete disenchantment, to dispassion, cessation and peace, to direct knowledge, enlightenment and nibbana. Of such things you may be certain. This is the Dhamma. This is the discipline. This is the Master's teaching. The next one is from Ankhutara 7, Sutta number 55. The Dhamma, monks, has been well expounded by the Tathagata. I do not see any ground on which an ascetic or Brahman or Deva or Mara or Brahma or anyone in the world might reasonably reproach me, saying, "For such a reason your Dhamma is not well expounded." Since I do not see any such ground, I dwell secure, fearless, and self-confident. The way leading to Nibbana has been well proclaimed by me to my disciples, so that my disciples who practice accordingly, by the destruction of the taints in this very life, enter and dwell in the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, having realized it for themselves by direct knowledge. I do not see any ground on which any ascetic or Brahman or Deva or Mara or Brahma or anyone in the world might reasonably reproach me, saying, "For such a reason, the way leading to Nibbana has not been well proclaimed by you." Since I do not see any such ground, I dwell secure, fearless, and self-confident. Many hundreds of disciples in my assembly, by the destruction of the taints, in this very life, enter and dwell in the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, having realized it for themselves by direct knowledge. I do not see any ground on which any ascetic or Brahman or Deva or Mara or Brahma or anyone in the world might reasonably reproach me, saying, "For such a reason, it is not true that many hundreds of disciples in your assembly enter and dwell in the taintless liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, having realized it for themselves by direct knowledge. Since I do not see any such ground, I dwell secure, fearless, and self-confident. These, monks, are the three ways in which I am irreproachable." This next one on the Dhamma is from Anguttara 3's, the 14th, Sutta number 14. And the theme that stood out for me with this one is just that even the Buddha himself shows respect and reverence for the Dhamma. The Blessed One said, "Monks, even a world ruler, a just and righteous king, does not govern his realm without a co-regent." When he had spoken, a certain monk addressed the Blessed One thus, "But who, Lord, is the co-regent of the world ruler, the just and righteous king?" It is the Dhamma, the law of righteousness, O monk, replied the Blessed One. In this case, the world ruler, the just and righteous king, relying on the law of righteousness, Dhamma, honoring it, regarding it highly, and respecting it, with the law of righteousness as his standard, banner, and sovereign, provides lawful protection, shelter, and safety for his own dependents. He provides lawful protection, shelter, and safety for the warrior nobles attending on him, for his army, for the Brahmins and householders, for the inhabitants of town and countryside, for ascetics and Brahmins, for the beasts and birds. A world ruler, a just and righteous king, who thus provides lawful protection, shelter, and safety for all, is the one who rules by righteousness only, and that rule cannot be overthrown by any hostile creature in human form. Even so, O monk, the Tathagata, the Arahant, the fully enlightened one, the just and righteous king of the Dhamma, relying on the Dhamma, honoring the Dhamma, regarding it highly and respecting it, with the Dhamma as his standard, banner, and sovereign, provides lawful protection, shelter, and safety in regard to action by body, speech, and mind. He teaches thus, such bodily action should be undertaken and such should not be undertaken. Such verbal action should be undertaken and such should not be undertaken. Such mental action should be undertaken and such should not be undertaken. The Tathagata, the Arahant, the fully enlightened one, the just and righteous king of the Dhamma, who thus provides lawful protection, shelter, and safety in regard to action by body, speech, and mind, is the one who turns the incomparable wheel of the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma only. And that wheel of the Dhamma cannot be turned back by any ascetic or Brahman, by any Deva or Mara or Brahma, or by anyone in the world. Go on to the section on the Sangha. Sangha is refuge, source of inspiration, confidence, so that there's energy applied in practice. This is just on the if monks there were no, this is from Anguttara 3's Sutta 102. If monks there were no gratification in the world, beings would not become attached to the world. But as there is gratification in the world, beings become attached to it. If there were no danger in the world, beings would not become disenchanted with the world. But as there is danger in the world, beings become disenchanted with it. If there were no escape from the world, beings could not escape from the world. But as there is an escape from the world, beings can escape from it. And that this is a theme that comes up in many places, the gratification, the danger, and the escape to different things, whether it's the world, the body, feelings, the sense of gratification is asada, which is also sort of pleasure or benefit. The danger is adinava, the harm, the punishment. And nisarana, the escape is the way out, the way out of it all. And this is sort of the theme of what the Sangha, are those who have seen that clearly. Anguttara 4 is number 7. And this is Discourse on Who Illuminates the Sangha. This is from Anguttara 4's Sutta number 7. Because these four who are accomplished in wisdom, discipline, confident, deeply learned, holders of Dhamma, who live in accordance with Dhamma, These four illuminate the Sangha. Which four? A bhikkhu who is accomplished in wisdom, discipline, confident, deeply learned, holder of Dhamma, who lives in accordance with Dhamma, illuminates the Sangha. A bhikkhuni who is accomplished in wisdom, male lay disciple who is accomplished in wisdom, female lay disciple who is accomplished in wisdom, disciplined, confident, deeply learned, holder of Dhamma, who lives in accordance with Dhamma, illuminates the Sangha. These Anguttara 4's Sutta number 190, in praise of the Sangha. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in the eastern park, in the mansion of Migara's mother. On that occasion, the Upasita day of the 15th, the Blessed One was sitting surrounded by the Sangha of monks. Then, surveying the silent Sangha of monks, the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, This assembly, O monks, is free from prattle, free from chatter. It is pure, established in the essence. The Sangha of monks is an assembly of a kind that is rarely seen in the world. This Sangha of monks is an assembly of a kind that is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutations, an unsurpassed field of merit for the world. This Sangha of monks is an assembly of a kind such that a small gift given to it becomes great, and a great gift still greater. This Sangha of monks is an assembly of a kind that would be worthy journeying many leagues to see, even with a travel bag. There are monks in this Sangha who dwell having attained the status of Devas, monks who dwell having attained the status of Brahma, monks who dwell having attained the imperturbable, monks who dwell having attained the status of noble ones. And how has a monk attained the status of a Deva? Here monks, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters and dwells in the first jhana. And so on through the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. It is in such a way that a monk has attained the status of a Deva. And how has a monk attained the status of a Brahma? Here, monks, a monk dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the second quarter, the third, and the fourth. Thus, above, below, across, and everywhere. And to all as to himself, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility and without ill will. He dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, with altruistic joy, with equanimity, without ill will. Vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility and without ill will. It is in such a way that a monk has attained the status of a Brahma. And how has a monk attained the imperturbable? Here, monks, with the complete transcendence of perceptions of forms, with the passing away of perceptions of sensory impingement, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, a monk enters and dwells in the base of the infinity of space. Then, by completely transcending the base of the infinity of space, aware that consciousness is infinite, a monk enters and dwells in the base of the infinity of consciousness. Then, by completely transcending the base of the infinity of consciousness, aware that there is nothing, a monk enters and dwells in the base of nothingness. Then, by completely transcending the base of nothingness, a monk enters and dwells in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. It is in such a way that a monk has attained the imperturbable. And how has a monk attained the status of a noble one? Here, monks, a monk understands as there really is. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is in such a way that a monk has attained the status of a noble one. Next one is Samyutta 22, Sutta number 80, and it's the Buddha himself sort of showing concern for the Sangha. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans at Kapilavattu in Nigrodha's park. Then the Blessed One, having dismissed the bhikkhus for a particular reason, see the last one, he's looking out and saying, this fine, wonderful Sangha, and this one, he's sort of dismissed them, sent them off somewhere. They're different groups. Having dismissed the bhikkhus for a particular reason, dressed in the morning and taking bowl and robe, entered Kapilavattu for alms. When he had walked for alms in Kapilavattu and had returned from the alms round, after his meal he went to the great wood for the day's abiding. Having plunged into the great wood, he sat down at the foot of a beluva sapling for the day's abiding. I wonder, there's a footnote on that. That'd be interesting. And the commentary was that after spending the rains retreat at Savatthi, the Buddha had set out for Kapilavattu together with a large company of bhikkhus. When they arrived, the Sakyans came to see him, bringing many gifts for the Sangha. A noisy quarrel broke out among the bhikkhus over the distribution of the gifts, and it was for this reason that the teacher dismissed them. He wanted to teach them, "It isn't for the sake of such things as robes, etc., that you have gone forth into homelessness, but for the sake of arahantship." Then, while the Blessed One was alone in seclusion, a reflection arose in his mind thus: "The Sangha bhikkhus has been dismissed by me. There are bhikkhus here who are newly ordained, not long gone forth, recently come to this Dhamma and discipline. If they do not see me, there may take place in them some alteration or change. Just as when a young calf does not see its mother, there may take place in it some alteration or change. So too there are bhikkhus here who are newly ordained, not long gone forth, recently come to this Dhamma and discipline. If they do not see me, there may take place in them some alteration or change. Just as when young seedlings do not get water, there may take place in them some alteration or change. So too, there are bhikkhus here who are newly ordained, not long gone forth, recently come to this Dhamma and discipline. If they do not see me, there may take place in them some alteration or change. Let me assist the Sangha bhikkhus. Let me assist the Sangha bhikkhus now, just as I have assisted in it in the past." Then Brahma Sahampati, having known with his own mind the reflection in the Blessed One's mind, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his drawn-in arm or draw in his extended arm, disappeared from the Brahma world and reappeared before the Blessed One. He arranged his upper robe over one shoulder, raised his joined hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One, and said to him, "So it is, Blessed One, so it is, Fortunate One. The Sangha bhikkhus has been dismissed by the Blessed One. There are bhikkhus here who are newly ordained." And goes through the whole thing. "If they do not see the Blessed One, there may take place in them some alteration or change. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One take delight in the Sangha bhikkhus. Let the Blessed One welcome the Sangha bhikkhus. Let the Blessed One assist the Sangha bhikkhus now, just as he has assisted it in the past." The Blessed One consented by silence. The Brahma Sahampati, having understood the Blessed One's consent, paid homage to the Blessed One, and keeping him on his right, he disappeared right there. Then in the evening, the Blessed One emerged from seclusion and went to Nigrodha's park. He sat down in the appointed seat and performed such a feat of spiritual power that the bhikkhus would come to him, alone and in pairs, in a timid manner. Then those bhikkhus approached the Blessed One, alone and in pairs, in a timid manner. Having approached, they paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down to one side. The Blessed One then said to them, "Bhikkhus, this is the lowest form of livelihood, that is, gathering alms. In the world, this is a term of abuse. You alms gatherer, you roam about with a begging bowl in your hand. And yet, bhikkhus, clansmen intent on the good take up that way of life for a valid reason. It is not because they have been driven to it by kings that they do so, nor because they have been driven to it by thieves, nor owing to debt, nor from fear, nor to earn a livelihood. But they do so with the thought, I am immersed in birth, aging, and death, in sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. I am immersed in suffering, oppressed by suffering. Perhaps an ending of this entire mass of suffering might be discerned. It is in such a way, bhikkhus, that this clansman has gone forth. Yet he is covetous, inflamed by lust for sensual pleasures, with a mind full of ill will, with intentions corrupted by hate, muddle-minded, lacking clear comprehension, unconcentrated, scatterbrained, loose in his sense faculties. Just as a brand from a funeral pyre, burning at both ends and smeared with excrement in the middle, cannot be used as timber either in the village or in the forest, in just such a way do I speak about this person. He has missed out on the enjoyments of a householder, yet he does not fulfill the goal of asceticism. There are, bhikkhus, these three kinds of unwholesome thoughts: sensual thought, thought of ill will, thought of harming. And where, bhikkhus, do these three unwholesome thoughts cease without remainder? For one who dwells with a mind well established in the four establishments of mindfulness, or for one who develops the signless concentration, this is reason enough, bhikkhus, to develop the signless concentration. When the signless concentration is developed and cultivated, bhikkhus, it is of great fruit and benefit. There are, bhikkhus, these two views, the view of existence and the view of extermination. Therein, bhikkhus, the instructed noble disciple reflects thus, is there anything in the world that I could cling to without being blameworthy? He understands thus, there is nothing in the world that I could cling to without being blameworthy. For if I should cling, it is only form that I would be clinging to, only feeling that I would be clinging to, only perception that I would be clinging to, only volitional formations that I would be clinging to, only consciousness that I would be clinging to. With that clinging of mine as condition, there would be existence. With existence as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair would come to be. Such would be the origin of this whole mass of suffering. What do you think, bhikkhus? Is form permanent or impermanent? Is feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, venerable sir. Seeing thus, he understands that there is no more for this state of being. That's it. It goes through the same formula from the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. It's a wonderful image, sort of a stick from a funeral pyre, burning at both ends and smeared with excrement in the middle. It doesn't get any worse than that. Okay. I'll just finish up this section with a few things that just sort of give an overview of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha as refuge. This is from Anguttara 4's Sutta number 34. It's titled The Best Kinds of Faith. Monks, there are four best kinds of faith. What for? Monks, among all living beings, be they footless or two-footed, with 4 feet or many feet, with form or formless, percipient, non-percipient, or neither percipient nor non-percipient, the Tathagata, the Arahant, the fully enlightened one, is reckoned the best of them all. Those who have faith in the Buddha have faith in the best, and for those who have faith in the best results will be theirs. Monks, among things conditioned, the Noble Eightfold Path is reckoned the best of them all. Those who have faith in the Noble Eightfold Path have faith in the best, and for those who have faith in the best result will be theirs. Monks, among things conditioned and unconditioned, dispassion is reckoned the best of them all. The crushing of all infatuation, the removal of thirst, the uprooting of attachment, the cutting off of the round of rebirth, the destruction of craving, dispassion, nibbana. Those who have faith in the Dhamma of dispassion have faith in the best, and for those who have faith in the best result will be theirs. Monks, among all religious orders or communities, the Sangha of the Tathagata's disciples is reckoned the best, that is to say, the four pairs of noble persons, the eight noble individuals. This Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, an unsurpassed field of merit for the world. Those who have faith in the Sangha have faith in the best, and for those who have faith in the best result will be theirs. These, O monks, are the four best kinds of faith. This next sutta is from Sanyutta 12, sutta number 23. This is the Upanissa Sutta. Upanissa means proximate cause. And again, with that theme of say, faith, this gives the sort of a hinging point around the say suffering and the rising of faith is the sort of a hinge point that turns it into a path of liberation. Thus, bhikkhus, with ignorance as proximate cause, volitional formations come to be. With volitional formations as proximate cause, consciousness. With consciousness as proximate cause, name and form. With name and form as proximate cause, the six sense bases. With the six sense bases as proximate cause, contact. With contact as proximate cause, feeling. With feeling as proximate cause, craving. With craving as proximate cause, clinging. With clinging as proximate cause, existence, bhava, becoming. With existence as proximate cause, birth. With birth as proximate cause, suffering. With suffering as proximate cause, faith. With faith as proximate cause, gladness. With gladness as proximate cause, rapture. With rapture as proximate cause, tranquility. With tranquility as proximate cause, happiness. With happiness as proximate cause, concentration. With concentration as proximate cause, the knowledge and vision of things as they really are. With the knowledge and vision of things as they really are as proximate cause, disenchantment. With disenchantment as proximate cause, dispassion. With dispassion as proximate cause, liberation. With liberation as proximate cause, the knowledge of destruction. Just as bhikkhus, when rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountain top, the water flows down along the slope and fills the cleft, gullies and creeks. These being full, fill up the pools. These being full, fill up the lakes. These being full, fill up the streams. These being full, fill up the rivers. And these being full, fill up the great ocean. So too with ignorance as proximate cause, and it goes through the whole sequence again. And the last sutta that I'll read today is Majjhima 89. And it's called the Monuments to the Dhamma. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at a town of the Sakyans named Medalumpa. Now, on that occasion, King Pasenadi of Kosala had arrived in Nagaraka for some business or other. Then he addressed Diga Karayana. Dear Karayana, have the state carriages prepared. Let us go to the pleasure garden to see a pleasing spot. Yes, sire, Digakarayana replied. When the state carriages were prepared, he informed the king, Sire, the state carriages are ready for you. Now is the time to do as you think fit. Then King Pasenadi mounted a state carriage, and accompanied by the other carriages, he drove out from Nagaraka with the full pomp of royalty and proceeded towards the park. He went thus as far as the road was passable for carriages, and then dismounted from his carriage and entered the park on foot. As he walked and wandered in the park for exercise, King Pasenadi saw roots of trees that were lovely and inspiring, quiet and undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat. The sight of these reminded him of the Blessed One thus, These roots of trees are lovely and inspiring, quiet and undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat, like the places where we used to pay respect to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. Then he told Digakarayana what he thought and asked, Where is he living now, the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened? There is, sire, a town of the Sakyans named Medlampa. The Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened, is now living there. How far is it from Nagaraka to Medlampa? It is not far, sire, 3 leagues. There is still daylight enough to go there. Then, dear Karayana, have the state carriages prepared. Let us go and see the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. Yes, sire, he replied. When the state carriages were prepared, he informed the king, Sire, the state carriages are ready for you. Now is the time to do as you think fit. Then King Pasenadi mounted a state carriage and, accompanied by the other carriages, set out from Nagaraka towards the Sakyan town of Medlampa. He arrived there while it was still daylight and proceeded towards the park. He went thus as far as the road was passable for carriages, and then he dismounted from his carriage and entered the park on foot. Now on that occasion a number of bhikkhus were walking up and down in the open. Then King Pasenadi went to them and asked, Venerable sirs, where is he living now, the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened? We want to see the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. That is his dwelling, great king, with the closed door. Go up to it quietly, without hurrying. Enter the porch, clear your throat, and tap on the panel. The Blessed One will open the door for you. King Pasenadi handed over his sword and turban to Digakarayana then and there. Then Digakarayana thought, So the king is going into secret session now, and I have to wait here alone now. Without hurrying, King Pasenadi went quietly up to the dwelling. With the closed door, entered the porch, cleared his throat, and tapped on the panel. The Blessed One opened his door. Then King Pasenadi entered the dwelling. Prostrating himself with his head at the Blessed One's feet, he covered the Blessed One's feet with kisses and caressed them with his hands, pronouncing his name. I am King Pasenadi of Kosala, Venerable Sir. I am King Pasenadi of Kosala, Venerable Sir. But great king, what reason do you see for doing such supreme honor to this body and for showing such friendship? Venerable Sir, I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. Now, Venerable Sir, I see some recluses and Brahmins leading a limited holy life for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, or 40 years. And then on a later occasion, I see them, well groomed and well anointed, with trimmed hair and beards, enjoying themselves, provided and endowed with 5 cords of sensual pleasure. But here I see bhikkhus leading the perfect and pure holy life as long as life and breath last. Indeed, I do not see any other holy life elsewhere as perfect and pure as this. This is why, Venerable Sir, I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. Again, Venerable Sir, kings quarrel with kings, nobles with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders, mother quarrels with child, child with mother, father with child, child with father, brother quarrels with brother, brother with sister, sister with brother, friend with friend. But here I see bhikkhus living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. I do not see any other assembly elsewhere with such concord. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. Again, Venerable Sir, I have walked and wandered from park to park and from garden to garden. There I have seen some recluses and Brahmins who are lean, wretched, unsightly, jaundiced, with veins standing out on their limbs, such that people would not want to look at them again. I have thought, surely these venerable ones are leading a holy life in discontent, or they have done some evil deed and are concealing it, so lean and wretched are they, such that people would not want to look at them again. I went up to them and asked, why are you, venerable ones, so lean and wretched, such that people would not want to look at you again? Their reply was, it is our family sickness, great king. But here I see bhikkhus smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their faculties fresh, living at ease, unruffled, subsisting on what others give, abiding with mind as aloof as a wild deer's. I have thought, surely these venerable ones perceive successive states of lofty distinction in the Blessed One's dispensation, since they abide thus smiling and cheerful, with mind as aloof as a wild deer's. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. Again, Venerable Sir, being a head-anointed noble king, I am able to have executed those who should be executed, to fine those who should be fined, to exile those who should be exiled. Yet when I am sitting in council, they break in and interrupt me. Though I say, gentlemen, do not break in and interrupt me when I am sitting in council. Wait till the end of my speech. Still they break in and interrupt me. But here I see bhikkhus, while the Blessed One is teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, and then there is not even a single sound. There is not even the sound of a disciple of the Blessed One coughing or clearing his throat. Once the Blessed One was teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, and there was a disciple of his cleared his throat. Thereupon one of his companions in the holy life nudged him with his knee to indicate, be quiet, Venerable Sir, make no noise. The Blessed One, the teacher, is teaching us the Dhamma. I thought, it is wonderful, it is marvelous, how an assembly can be so well disciplined without force or weapon. Indeed, I do not see any other assembly elsewhere so well disciplined. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer according to the Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. Again, Venerable Sir, I have seen here certain learned nobles who were clever, knowledgeable about the doctrines of others, as sharp as hair-splitting marksmen. They wander about, as it were, demolishing the views of others with their sharp wits. When they hear the recluse Gotama will visit such and such a village or town, they formulate a question thus, we will go to the recluse Gotama and ask him this question. If he is asked like this, he will answer like this, and so we will refute his doctrine in this way. And if he is asked like that, he will answer like that, and so we will refute his doctrine in that way. They hear, the recluse Gotama has come to visit such and such a village or town. They go to the Blessed One, and the Blessed One instructs, urges, rouses, and encourages them with a talk on the Dhamma. After they have been instructed, urged, roused, and encouraged by the Blessed One with a talk on the Dhamma, they do not so much as ask him the question, so how should they refute his doctrine? In actual fact, they become his disciples. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. Again, Venerable Sir, I've seen here certain learned Brahmins and certain learned householders, certain learned recluses. Goes through the whole thing again of refuting doctrines. They do not so much as ask him the question, so how should they refute his doctrine? In actual fact, they ask the Blessed One to allow them to go forth from the home life into homelessness, and he gives them the going forth. Not long after they have thus gone forth, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, they here and now enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. They say thus, we were very nearly lost, we very nearly perished. For formerly we claimed that we were recluses, though we were not really recluses. We claimed that we were Brahmins, though we were not really Brahmins. We claimed that we were Arahants, though we were not really Arahants. But now we are recluses, now we are Brahmins, now we are Arahants. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. Again, Venerable Sir, Isidatta and Purana, my two inspectors, eat my food and use my carriages. I provide them with a livelihood and bring them fame. Yet in spite of this, they are less respectful towards me than they are towards the Blessed One. Once when I had gone out leading an army and was testing these inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, I happened to put up in very cramped quarters. Then these two inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, after spending much of the night in talk on the Dhamma, lay down with their heads in the direction where they had heard that the Blessed One was staying, and with their feet towards me. I thought, it is wonderful, it is marvelous. These two inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, eat my food and use my carriages. I provide them with a livelihood and bring them fame. Yet in spite of this, they are less respectful towards me than they are towards the Blessed One. Surely these good people perceive successive states of lofty distinction in the Blessed One's dispensation. This too, Venerable Sir, is why I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. Again, Venerable Sir, the Blessed One is a noble, and I am a noble. The Blessed One is a Kosalan, and I am a Kosalan. The Blessed One is 80 years old, and I am 80 years old. Since that is so, I think it proper to do such supreme honor to the Blessed One and to show such friendship. And now, Venerable Sir, we depart. We are busy and have much to do. Now is the time, Great King, to do as you think fit. Then King Pasenadi of Kosala rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. Then, soon after he had left, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, before rising from his seat and departing, this King Pasenadi uttered monuments to the Dhamma. Learn the monuments to the Dhamma, Bhikkhu. Master the monuments to the Dhamma. Remember the monuments to the Dhamma. The monuments to the Dhamma are beneficial, Bhikkhus, and they belong to the fundamentals of the holy life. That is what the Blessed One said. The Bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Monuments to the Dhamma means words expressing reverence to the Dhamma. Whenever reverence is shown towards any of the three jewels, it is also shown to the others.
Okay.